Between 1915 and 1970, 6 million black Americans moved from the South to cities in the North. Isabel Wilkerson tells the story of this great migration and discusses how racism shaped our country during that time in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. In 1994, when she was at the New York Times, Professor Wilkerson won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Now she's a professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed our conversation, and we thought that we would rebroadcast it for you today. I start off by congratulating Isabel Wilkerson on the amazing reviews that she'd received for the book. In fact, I told her, I had yet to read anything negative.
It has been so gratifying, especially after 15 years of working on it.
And did you know all those 15 years that you were going to finally complete this thing?
I knew once I started that not finishing was simply not an option. So once I was into it, I had to finish it. I just had no idea it was going to take as long as it did.
Well, you did a lot of research, did a lot of interviews. Did you know from the start that the book would have this take on this kind of shape and that you'd focus on only a few people, actually?
Yeah, I gave a great deal of thought to the idea of being able to tell the story through three people who would represent the breadth and the scope of this migration, which started in 1915, ended in 1970, and essentially was an outpouring of African Americans from all parts of the South, but not this haphazard unfurling of lost souls. It was actually a situation in which there were three different migration streams, and I wanted to be able to capture each one through each of the three main protagonists.
Was it simply the difficulties of living in the Jim Crow South that prompted the Great Migration?
There was pent-up desire to leave for many decades after the Emancipation Proclamation, and many of the people would have wanted to have left.
And why didn't more people leave when the tide turned in the late 19th century? Why wait until 1915?
Really good question. The reason is because they didn't have any sense that there would be any possibility of being able to make a living in these big anonymous industrial cities until during World War I. And that was when, because Europe was at war, the North, which had relied on the labor from immigrants from Europe, no longer had that same ready supply of labor. And so therefore they went looking to what essentially was the emerging market of the United States at that time, which was the South. They were looking for the cheapest labor they could find, which was African Americans, who in the South, many of them were being paid. They were not being paid because they were literally working for the right to live on the land they were farming as sharecroppers.
So sharecropping wasn't all that much an improvement over slavery?
Not at all. Not very much.
And weren't there other kinds of jobs, or were all the regular jobs in the South only reserved for whites?
Well, in some ways, I describe the Great Migration, which involved 6 million people leaving the South for all points, North, Midwest, and West. I describe it as a defection from the caste system known as Jim Crow. It was as much a defection as it was a migration. In some ways, they were seeking political asylum from a system that controlled their every move. For example, it was against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. It was against the law. Someone actually sat down and wrote that as a law.
You have to wonder what was going on in the mind of that lawmaker.
He must have seen a white person and a black person having a little bit too much fun and said, this is going to be the end of Southern civilization as we know it.
Where did Jim Crow begin, and how did it get its name?
Jim Crow actually began as a it was the name of a song. It was a song that was popularly performed by a minstrel singer in the mid to late 19th century, and it caught the fancy of Southerners. It was actually a mockery of a handicapped slave who was thought to have lived in Kentucky. And this became a big sensation. The minstrel singer went all over the country, got very rich from doing that. And then later in life, when he was maybe in his 50s, he actually got very ill with a kind of paralysis, which meant that he'd been mocking this paralyzed person and ended up being paralyzed himself and died at a fairly young age.
How soon after the Civil War did the Jim Crow laws start being enacted?
The Jim Crow laws began being enacted in 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the first test case for it. That involved a case of a man who, an African American man who boarded the white car in the railroad in Louisiana, went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court voted overwhelmingly in favor of the South's decision to have separate but quote unquote equal accommodations.
And then that freed up every state that wanted to make laws that had had a racial component to them. Was it just the South, or were we seeing some Jim Crow laws in the North as well?
In the North, it was not spoken. It wasn't. You didn't see the signs.
It was de facto.
It was de facto and whimsical in some ways. It was whatever the proprietor chose to do. So it was much less. It was much less predictable in the North.
The way Ron Paul says things should be today. I don't know if you've heard about that. Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, is published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When you were doing this research, did you find that the people you were talking to, the black people you were talking to, were really aware of this story?
That is such a great question, because I, you know, interviewed over 1,200 people for this book. I went to senior centers all over, from New York to Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, Oakland, Milwaukee, and I talked to all these people who were part of this major event, and most of them didn't think of themselves as part of the Great Migration. I would say to them, well, if you migrated from Louisiana to California between these years and you were part of the Great Migration, and they'd say, well, I came in 1947. Does that make me part of it? And I'd say yes. And they'd say, really?
Because they thought that was late.
Well, they viewed themselves as making individual decisions for themselves. This was a leaderless revolution. There was no one who set the time and the date for this migration. There was no one who could say when it would end, because it continued on and on as more people had great grandparents and other great aunts who were here. And it just took on a life of its own.
So does it end with civil rights legislation?
It ends in the 1970s, essentially 1970, when the initial major reasons for this migration were no longer there, meaning that was the end of the Jim Crow system.
And then we started hearing about a migration back to the South.
And we started hearing about it, because in some ways one of the legacies of the Great Migration is that it helped the South to change. It was a precursor to the Civil Rights Movement.
How do you feel about the way that the American educational system teaches the history of race in America, especially this period?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book. I grew up as the daughter of this great migration. I was surrounded by people. My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia to Washington, D.C. at the end of World War II. My father came several years later from another state, from the southern part of Virginia to Washington. Without this migration, had my parents not participated, I wouldn't exist. The majority of African Americans that you meet in the North, the Midwest, and West are descendants of this great migration. And yet, where was the grapes of wrath for this great migration of 6 million people within the borders of our own country? So I felt that there was this great gap in understanding why they did what they did. What were the circumstances that they were leaving, and what ultimately happened to them?
Well, when they arrived, were they treated well, or were they treated the way some immigrants are from other countries are treated here today?
They were treated with a great deal of resentment and hostility, in the same way that immigrants arriving now. There's something about
even
the
though
human
they were
spirit.
Americans,
even
they were seen
they were
as
American.
Outsiders.
Oh, absolutely, because they were outsiders to the region that they were coming to. They were visibly people of the land, and or from small towns. They didn't have the northern big city ways, and they stood out dramatically because of their race and their bearing. They were not schooled in the ways of the North, and they had to learn a way through.
Your parents chose to go to Washington, which was essentially a southern town, also segregated. They could have come to New York. They could have gone to Chicago. They could have gone to Los Angeles. Why Washington?
Well, in my own family, actually, there are people who came to New York. So they had relatives in all these different places. But Washington is a little different, because Washington was the capital of the Union. So in the South, Washington is viewed very much as the North. Mississippi does not view Washington, D.C. as the South.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting there.
Even though often it was actually a segregated city until The civil rights laws changed things, and partly that was because Congress controlled the laws and Congress had these entrenched Southerners in power.
Well, you know what? What's interesting about it is that the borders of the South were different even among themselves. In other words, there were certain things that you could do in Washington that you couldn't do in Georgia, where my mother was from. You could still ride the front of the bus, for example, in Washington. So there were incremental advantages just to crossing the border into Washington. It was the beginning of the Jim Crow South.
Were black people expected to know the particular Jim Crow laws of a given area of the South?
They had to if they were going to survive. They absolutely had
to. So if you went from Georgia to Alabama, you had to learn a whole set of new rules?
You know what ended up happening is people generally made the assumption that things were more extreme than they might have even have been because they couldn't take the chance of crossing the line in a state where they did not know what was actually acceptable or not. So they tended to, for example, people riding the train from Mississippi to Chicago or riding the bus often said that even though there was a point at which they could have gone to the integrated train or part of the train, they didn't go. Mm-hmm. They said you didn't do that because you just didn't know where Jim Crow ended and where it began.
Did black people have much power to rebel against some of the laws in the South?
Not at the time, not really. I mean, there was a lynching every 3 days for a good portion of the 20th century.
And the NAACP, other organizations, were formed because of those lynchings. Why didn't the federal government intervene?
That is a very good question. I think partly in some ways that are relevant to today's politics, the South is huge. It's a huge region of the country, and many people who were running for public office who were national politicians really had to rely on the South for those votes. They couldn't afford to alienate the South at that time. And remember, the major voters were going to be white voters, that black people couldn't vote on the whole in the South.
You say that in the 19-teens, young whites were particularly hostile toward blacks. Why was that? Why the 19-teens?
That was because Jim Crow had so effectively separated the races that in some ways it was a loss to both black people and to white people in the South. They were so segregated that in some courthouses there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on, which meant that almost in every sphere of life, every possible opportunity for a black person and a white person to get to know one another, those things were cut off to both blacks and to whites. And so there was not that same sense of ability to have that kind of social understanding or intimacy that would have been in effect, oddly enough, during slavery. They just simply didn't know one another.
Of course, the 19-teens is when the Great Migration begins.
Yes.
And partly because of that, I'm assuming.
Absolutely.
Did you interview any relatives of Southern whites who enforced the Jim Crow laws or were heirs of slave owners?
You know, what I ended up doing was I ended up talking to the people who often do not get talked to. There was such a wealth of material from people from the part of the caste system that you describe. There were, you know, so many newspaper articles and editorials written about how the Southern elites were trying to figure out what to do. There was such a wealth of material that I actually had more than I could possibly even include in the book. The book has actually a lot of wonderful excerpts from the hand-wringing of the Southern planters who were trying to figure out what should we do. Maybe it's better that they go and then the North will see what we've been dealing with. And others would say, we must stop this now because our very lifeblood is leaving us. So I actually found that there was such a wealth of material that I ended up focusing on the people who hardly ever get spoken to before.
So there were people in the South who realized that the migration was actually going to hurt them.
Absolutely.
On an economic level, but were not willing to change the laws?
They couldn't come to any agreement as to what to do. I mean, the economic system of the South was built upon cheap labor. They needed to have hands in the fields in order to pick that cotton. They needed to have people to help raise their children. The entire system was set up on this cheap to almost free labor, and there was not a critical mass of people who were willing to go up against that system. Everybody in a caste system is kind of held in place. If you think about what a caste does. CAST,
mm-hmm.
What it does to someone. It actually holds you firmly in place. So there would have been a lot of strictures and a lot of limits on anyone who wanted to do otherwise.
Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, is published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We We're back with an interview I did this past September with Isabel Wilkerson, who had won a Pulitzer Prize years ago when she was at the New York Times. She's worked for any number of different publications as well, winning the George Polk Award and a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship along the way. Now she's a professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. She was on our show to discuss her book about the Great Migration called The Warmth of Other Suns. I start off the second part of that interview by reading this rather long comment from a listener who'd left it on our show page. Both my parents and in-laws were part of the Great Migration. My father came from Cleveland, Tennessee to Harlem in 1959. He was 20 years old. He had $8 in his pocket, a couple of Miles Davis records, and only a name of a friend of his mother's who let him stay with her until he got a job in a room. My mother came in 1942. She was six. My grandparents were driven from their home in Branchville, South Carolina, because as farmers, the ruling caste refused to pay fair shares on their produce. My grandfather had a temper, and my great-grandmother urged him to move out of the South before he was lynched. He left first, leaving my grandmother with a six-year-old, a two-year-old, who had polio and an infant. He found work first in Philadelphia and then moved in with his sisters in the Bronx and sent for his family. My in-laws were from the same plantation in Sunflower, Mississippi. They were sharecroppers. One night, they just left. My mother-in-law says that if they didn't, the white people who owned the plantation would never have let them leave. They took the train to Chicago, where my husband's extended family had moved to. My family have just begun talking about these events after my grandfather died. While he was alive, he didn't want to talk about the horrors of the South. He didn't want his family to ever know. He had been scared for his life then. He didn't want his family to know he had to run. He didn't want to appear weak. Little did he know, we all think his actions were probably the most courageous thing that he could have done.
Oh my God.
But this is kind of like the stories you heard and you record in this book.
What that listener has written is exactly why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote the book, because those stories needed to be told. African-Americans who were part of this needed to begin to talk more about this, because this is a lost history if it's not told. And really, the country needs to be able to have a better understanding of how much we have in common, actually, meaning that these people were leaving for the same thing that anyone else who might have left Europe crossing the Atlantic in steerage or crossing the Pacific Ocean or the Rio Grande. In other words, they wanted to be free. They wanted to be free of the caste system and repression that they were under. And it just warms my heart to hear the story that you just described. I heard so many stories like that.
Well, how did you decide on George Swanson, Robert Pershing Foster, and Ida Mae Gladney to focus in your book?
Well, each one of them represents one of the streams of the migration. They all left from different parts of the South to head to the North. George Swanson Starling left Florida in 1945, really fleeing for his life after he had been trying to organize the citrus pickers in his home state of Florida. He ran right smack into the caste system that didn't allow such things to occur, and he fled for his life and came to Harlem in 1945. Ida Mae Gladney was a sharecropper's wife who was terrible at picking cotton. She could kill a snake, but she couldn't pick cotton. So it had turned out that one of her husband's cousins happened to have been accused of a theft that he had not committed, was beaten to within an inch of his life. And after that happened, well, it turned out that the thing that he had supposedly stolen turned up the next day. But after her husband saw what had happened, he told his wife, "This is the last crop we're making," and they set off ultimately for Chicago. And then the third person was Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He was a physician, a surgeon, and a well-regarded one who'd served his country in the Army during the Korean War. He got out of the Army and returned to Monroe, Louisiana, to discover that he could not practice surgery or be a physician in his hometown. And so he set off on a perilous journey, much more perilous than he had anticipated, because of what we were talking before about where does Jim Crow end during that era. And he just set out for California in 1953.
Were situations better in California than they were in some of the de facto segregated northern cities?
I would say marginally better, but with the caveat that the people who were part of this great migration were in such a tightly restricted world, which comes through in the reader's statement, that they were really their goals were modest. Their dreams were fairly modest. They weren't looking to run Fortune 500 companies and own skyscrapers. They were looking to be able to get their children into schools that would be better better education for their kids and being able to own a home, be able to save up a little something, get paid, for example. Many of the sharecroppers were not being paid. So they met with tremendous, tremendous resistance and hostility. They found there were neighborhoods they couldn't move into. There were unions that would not permit them to join. They had a really difficult time.
And many of them left without their families and then had to send for their families, similar to the story we just heard. But Robert Foster actually faced a different kind of racism when he tried to be a doctor in California. Black people didn't want to come.
Yes, I mean, it turned out that there was stratification in these new cities that they arrived in, which actually created yet another barrier for them. In some ways, it's just sort of a human immigrant reaction in some ways. I mean, these people were not immigrants because they were American citizens. And they should not have had to have traveled as far as they did in order to realize the rights that they were born to. However, there was a kind of immigrant heart that they had, and they met resistance in the same way that many immigrants do.
Now, I'm assuming that what happened is similar to what I've seen with Mexican immigration. Somebody went to Chicago or to Detroit or to New York or whatever, and then told friends to come up there because there were jobs, and then brought family up. And the next thing you knew, you had a little community.
Yeah, and in fact, in many of these states, there were and still are state clubs that represent the small towns that the people originally came from. For example, there's a Lake Charles, Louisiana club in Los Angeles. There's a Greenwood, Mississippi club in Chicago. There are churches where many people here in New York, many people will be from South Carolina. So it continues that stream.
How important were the churches and religion?
The churches were tremendously important. In fact, many of the big churches that we know of now that we consider institutions in the Great North were built up. They got their congregations were built up because these people were coming up from the South. Many, many institutions, the Urban League and Abyssinian Baptist Church, for example, in some ways their populations grew, their roles grew because they were getting new congregants and new clients and new people.
Before they left, did they must have had some kind of image of what life would be like in the North or in the West? Were they disappointed?
Well, one of the funny things about it is that the people who were up there already made a big show of coming back. Oh, they bought new clothes. They had what they called sort of their northern wad of cash, which would be all these ones, and then on the outside would be wrapped a 20 or a 50, and people would be amazed in the South by seeing all of the money that they were made. They'd come back in big cars. And another thing that they did is that they sent money back home. There was the sense that life could be freer and that they could actually make a life for themselves if they came to the North, because they could see that there were people who at least were putting on the show that they were doing well up here.
A caller wonders about the impact of World War I and World War II on the Great Migration. How did the mechanization of the South have an effect on it?
Well, World War One was, in fact, the great impetus of it, because World War One created the opportunity for people to actually come up here. Northern industries actually went to the South to recruit. They actively recruited people. People just didn't come up here on their own in some ways.
Ford.
They actually sent them tickets. There was International Harvester and Pennsylvania Railroad were two of the bigger names that people know about. And they would go in and they would recruit. The South had took a tremendous effort to keep them from leaving. They would actually, there'd be large numbers of African Americans waiting on the railroad platforms, and they would actually arrest them wholesale. They'd arrest them on peonage charges or saying that they owed a debt to their planter. They would board the trains and arrest people because they could see their cheap labor leaving.
Mm. Well, that also worked to some degree in the North. I was thinking about Henry Ford, who hired a lot of black people to work in his factories for all sorts of reasons, among them to because he had a reputation for being a bigot, but also because he felt that the black workers would be grateful to him, they wouldn't join unions, and they would work for less money.
Many of the African Americans were brought in as strike breakers, and in some ways that reminds me of one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, and that is that people who were coming in from other parts of the world as immigrants, from parts of Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, from parts of Asia and other places, were people of the land, just as the people who were coming up from the South. And what a tragedy that these people who were essentially the same people, people of the land coming from a repressive place, often seeking some type of asylum, were so similar, but they were torn asunder because the economy really, the system was set up to divide them.
My guest is Isabel Wilkerson, whose book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, is already being hailed as a major work of history. It's published by Random House. What about the people who stayed?
Yeah, the people who stayed. The people who
stayed. Were they the ones who were just the poorest?
The people who stayed, on the whole, had slightly less education than those who had left. The people who left were the ones who had more of an agitation within them for something better. There's something different about people. Anyone who leave the only place you've ever known or a place you've never seen in hopes that life will be better. So there was a difference between the two. But there was a role that both of them played in the ultimate sort of moment of truth for the South and for this country. And that was that the civil rights movement had to be fought in the South, and the people who stayed were the ones to fight it. The people in the North were a part of that from afar. They did several things. One is they sent money to help finance it. Another was that they offered a sense of exposure to what could be. Even though they were having a hard time themselves, they were making enough money to send back home. They were sending their children to better schools. So that exposed people to something better, those in the South who stayed. And then finally, the people who were in the North offered a kind of leverage for the people in the South as they were putting their lives on the line, because if things got really difficult, they had a great aunt that they could come to in the North. And they worked together on it. The lovely thing about the people in the South is that a lot of times they would say to the people as they were on their way leaving, there was always often a big show, there'd be a prayer or something, tears, and they would say, "We must stay so that you'll have a place to come back to."
Mike, one of our listeners, left a question on our show page. He writes, "It seems like most people that migrated were from the rural South. What about those who lived in cities like New Orleans, Atlanta, Memphis, et cetera? Was it easier in Southern cities than on the farms, or did most Southern blacks live in the country rather than in the cities?"
No, most of them would have been in rural areas or small towns. But during the Great Migration, the majority of them would have been in rural areas or small towns. And one of the things that they would often do is they'd move to the city nearest them and then use that as a launching pad to get to the North.
Now, it's interesting that Frederick Douglass, later Booker T. Washington, encouraged African Americans to stay in the South. What would America look like if they had listened to them?
Well, first of all, at the beginning of the century, the beginning of the migration, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the migration in 1970, half were living outside of the South. So that's one big thing there. I mean, in other words, this was a redistribution of a great portion of the population in this country that happened within the border of this country. Also, there's so many cultural touchstones that would not have occurred because the people who were the children of this migration would not have had the opportunities that they had. For example, Toni Morrison and the novelist, August Wilson, the playwright, Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, all of these people were products of the Great Migration. They would not have had the opportunities to do what they did had there been no Great Migration. Motown simply wouldn't have existed because the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy, his parents migrated from Georgia to Detroit. And when he got to be a grown man, he began to recruit from the people around him, the young people around him, all of whom were children of the Great Migration.
And
most
of the great jazz musicians.
The jazz
were
musicians.
Children of the Great
Miles
Migration.
Davis, his parents migrated from Arkansas to Illinois, where if they'd stayed in the cotton country of Arkansas, there's no way he would have been able to devote the hours upon hours to music as he had. And Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to Harlem when he was 5 years old. He, too, had the luxury, one might say, of being able to take music classes, to be able to study music and devote time to music, which he never would have been able to do in tobacco country of North Carolina. And then John Coltrane. John Coltrane left North Carolina for Philadelphia when he was 17, and it was there in Philadelphia that he got his first alto sax. Where would music be? Where would jazz be? Where would culture be had he not gotten an alto sax in Philadelphia?
I understand that Newark got a large African-American population because people thought that the conductor was saying New York.
Yes, there are two Penn stations, two Pennsylvania stations, and after a 20-hour ride all the way from Georgia, they thought that
the Penn Station, Newark, was maybe just the way the Northerners pronounced New York.
Mm. Well, in were people one of the things that that comment that I read suggested is that people were reluctant to talk about their experiences in the South before they came to the North. When you interviewed all these different people, how many altogether?
1,200.
Were most of them really eager to talk?
The ones that I ended up running into, the ones that I spent the most time with, clearly were at a time in their lives where they were willing to talk. So there were people who had. They'd lived with it, and they'd come to terms with it. But there are many, many other people who did not feel comfortable talking about it. In some ways, that's one reason why the story has not really been told, because people, as the listener said, were reluctant to talk about it. They didn't want their children to know. And my goal with this book would be that it would make everyone of whatever ethnicity or background go back to whoever is in their family who can still tell those stories. It's in all of our backgrounds, someone who left someplace far away for us to be here.
In fact, we hear similar stories from children of Holocaust survivors that their parents did not want to talk about what they'd experienced in Europe, even though it's such an important story to tell.
Absolutely.
So do you think this is going to open up a whole new area of a way of looking at American history?
I would hope that it would help fill in the blanks of history and help readers. I mean, the goal of this is to help readers to imagine themselves in that world, both in the South and having to make that decision. And hopefully it'll make people, those who have survived to this day, those who can still tell their stories, validate their stories and help them feel like they'll be more willing to tell and share it with their families while they still can.
Isabel Wilkerson won a Pulitzer Prize when she was at the New York Times. I suspect there are more surprises in store as a result of the publication of her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. It is published by Random House, and it has been my great pleasure to have you as my guest today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.